Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle. I'm Bobby Osinski, and this is a show all about music, music production, and the music business. My guest this week is engineer and producer Greg Penny. First of all, Amazon Music is now the fastest growing streaming music service. You would think it would be Spotify or Apple Music, and yes, those are both growing at a pretty good pace as well, but Amazon Music is the fastest. It's growing by over 70%. They don't release these figures, but it's been rumored that it now has over 32 million paid subscribers. In comparison, Apple Music has 60 million and Spotify is at about 100 million. One of the interesting things about Amazon Music is they recently introduced a free tier on all Alexa devices. They also have a discounted tier if you're using an Alexa device. And there's a rumor that they're going to have a high fidelity, high res tier coming soon, although that can't be confirmed. It's just a rumor, but I wouldn't be surprised. So Amazon is really growing. And of course, this was one of my predictions at the beginning of the year, that Amazon would grow faster than most people realize, and they become a real player in the streaming music business. And it looks like that's happening. Of course, one of the big reasons why they're a player is because of those voice-actuated devices. And voice is a really big deal right now. And smart speakers are a really big deal. And that's pushing Amazon Music faster than just about anything. One of the interesting things about Amazon is the fact that the people that listen to it tend to lean more towards country music than anything else. Now, if you look at the charts on Spotify, for instance, that's leaning more hip-hop. That's not the case on Amazon. So it will be interesting to see if that continues as Amazon grows. Part of it, I think, is the fact that so many of Amazon's subscribers and so many of the users of Amazon Music are Prime members. Prime members already have to spend a lot of dough, $100 plus, every year just for that. And that eliminates some of the audience. By the end of the year, we should know a lot more. And again, all these things in music pick up starting September. The fall is the heaviest use time for everything about music, the heaviest consumption. So by the end of the year, we may have a different outlook on what streaming networks are actually going to be the leader of the pack going forward. If you have any questions or comments, you can send them to questions@BobbyOInnerCircle.com. Don't forget about my online courses on mixing, production, branding, and music business success at BobbyOsinskiCourses.com. Also, get an expert analysis and objective opinion of your songs and mixes as a member of my Hitmakers Club. Go to HitmakersClub.com to learn more. Now, here's something that people never thought would happen. Aerosmith actually has a short-term residence in Las Vegas. Yeah, they're going to be at the Park MGM Grand, formerly the Monte Carlo, for those of you familiar with the hotel layout of Las Vegas, of the Strip. It's short-term in that they're only going to be there 5 to 7 days a month. I think in November they're there for 2 weeks. But for the most part, they're out on the road and they're just in Vegas for short periods of time. That being said, the setup at the Park MGM Grand is way different from most concerts. In fact, this is a live, immersive audio experience. Most concerts have 2 or 3 line arrays above the stage, and that's what supplies everything you hear. Now, in this case, they're using something called the L-ISA, Immersive Hyperreal Sound from L Acoustics. There's 9 line arrays above the stage, 38 surround speakers mounted on the balcony edge, 22 overhead speakers, and 24 subwoofers. These are all permanently installed in the theater at the Park MGM Grand. What's more, it's all THX certified. There's the typical front-of-house mixer, but there also has to be a dedicated L-ISA engineer. So for the immersive audio, there's a separate engineer just for that. What I think is particularly interesting here is that there's a VIP section which lets you sit on the stage. Now, if you opt for that, you get your own set of IEMs, in-ear monitors. These are the One More triple driver system. And they're connected to a custom iPod that's connected to a dedicated closed Wi-Fi system. you're able to select between either the house mix or Steven Tyler's mix. This was all put together by a company called Mix Halo. And Mix Halo recently was in the news by doing Elton John with this pretty much same setup, only it was out in the audience, where you could select between different mixes of members of the band. This is a little different, though, because if you're out in the audience, you're getting the immersive sound experience. If you're on the stage, you're paying a lot more money, and you're only getting the in-ear monitor experience. You're not getting 3D sound at all. These are fairly expensive seats in general. It goes anywhere between $178 to about $4,500 to be in the audience. On stage, you're going to pay anywhere between $822 and $2,500 or so. Plus, you have a limited view and you won't have immersive audio, but you know what? You're going to be on the stage. So for many people, that's what they really want. So if you want to see and hear Aerosmith in a very unique environment, go experience them in immersive audio at the Park MGM Grand in Las Vegas. Now, speaking of immersive audio, my guest today is at the forefront of mixing music in Dolby Atmos. Greg Penny produced hits with Katie Lang, Cher, and Paul Young, among others, but a meeting with Elton John while Greg was in his teens turned into an award-winning journey with the legend many years down the road. Besides producing and mixing Elton's mini albums and surround, Greg is now mixing them in the latest immersive audio format, and he'll tell us more about how it all works in just a bit. During the interview, we spoke about sitting in on Elton's Yellow Brick Road sessions, the difference between mixing in Atmos and 5.1, recording the Vatican Choir in surround, and much, much more. I spoke with Greg via Skype from a studio in Ojai, California. For those listeners who don't know your background, let's start there, because you have one of the most colorful and interesting backgrounds of anybody I know, actually.
Oh, that's very kind.
So let's talk about how you got into the business.
Well, I was born into a music business family. My father's name is Hank Penny. Name was Hank Penny. He was a band leader, songwriter, extraordinary guitarist. And he started his career in Birmingham, Alabama, and then eventually worked his way to the West Coast, Hollywood. Became a successful songwriter and comedian, and met my mother, Sue Thompson, who was at that time singing in Dude Martin's band in San Francisco. And they both together joined the Spade Cooley television show in Hollywood in the early 50s. As my dad as the stand-up comedian, guitarist, and my mom as the lead singer. And soon after that, I came into the picture. And then they took advantage of with the demise of regional television and the business associated with that and the rise of national television, it put a lot of people sort of out of work. And my folks were on this regional television show in LA. So they decided to follow the pattern of Louis Prima and Keeley Smith and go to Nevada and set up shop touring the Nevada circuit with the occasional trip into LA and other places. So, we moved to Nevada in the mid 50s when it was super alive and very active, and we were able to live up there. And then as time went on, my mother started having huge pop hit records and had to sort of abandon her cycle in the Nevada circuit and became a pop star again in her mid 30s. With records like Sad Movies, Always Make Me Cry, Norman, James, those. So we stayed in Vegas, but I was excited to come to L.A. So by the time I was 16, I was basically relocated to L.A. And I worked for the Dinah Shore show for a while as a production assistant. A friend of mine got me a job there. And that was a great gig because it put me around a lot of really, really super creative people. Everybody from Fred Astaire to David Bowie to – it was pretty amazing. But my real want was to be a record producer. So – I sought out a gig in the record companies, and I got hired at Warner Brothers Music in L.A. as a song plugger or a professional manager. And as I moved up through that company pretty quickly, Rob Dickens, who ran Warner Brothers Music in the U.K., invited me to come to work for him in England. So I went to England to work for him on a label called Corova Records. It was a joint partnership between Warner Brothers Music and Seymour Stein at Sire Records. So we had Echo and the Bunnymen and The Sound, Betty Bright, a lot of the camp that had moved down to London from Liverpool on our label. And I worked there for about 2 years for Rob. And then I decided that probably the best thing for me to do to push my career as a producer forward was back to LA. So I came back to Hollywood and started producing. Westlake Audio used to give me time in the middle of the night there in the early 80s. And I would do my demos or my semi-masters and take them out to Warner Brothers and peddle them and see if I could get the artist a deal and me a deal producing. And eventually it stuck, and I produced this this record with a band called Martini Ranch that was Bill Paxton's band. And from doing that, I worked with Mark Thompson, who later and is currently known as Chocolate Genius. And then from that, I got the Katie Lang job. I was introduced to Katie and started working with her and did 3 albums and a bunch of things in between with her. And from that, I sort of rekindled an old friendship with Elton because he was a huge fan of her records. Knew that I was producing, but had never thought of me as a producer. So my intro to working again, or finally working with Elton after being friends for many years, was him calling me to ask me to do a duet with him and Katie. So Katie and I went along and saw him, and we concocted a cool arrangement on a Womack and Womack song called Teardrops, and did that together. And that led to me doing the whole of the duets album with Elton. So lots of different artists I got to work with on that album, Little Richard and PM Dawn and Don Henley, Stevie Wonder did a Gladys Knight track. And then Elton asked me to produce his next studio album. So I went to England and started that. And then Elton kept me busy for about 4 years just doing his stuff. So there's been a lot of stuff, but it's been great. It's been amazing. And subsequently from that, the relationship, because of Elton's longtime producer, Gus Dudgeon, passing away, unfortunately, in the early 2000s, I think it was 2000, there was no one in his camp that could really look after his catalog and to start to repurpose it. And you and I have talked about that catalog and listened through a lot of the stuff.
Yeah.
So I suggested that I start with things that I had produced since I knew them well, but that we eventually work through and try to do multi-channel mixes, 5.1 mixes, etc. Repurpose the catalog. And that led to actually going and finding the master tapes in London and then baking what had to be baked, you know, all the restorative stuff that comes with it. But we built an amazing digital archive of 12 of Elton's classic albums and sort of brought them out from the vaults, really, because Universal at that time was, his deal was with PolyGram. And at that time, they hadn't really done anything. So we got those masters out and started working with them. And as you know, we were able to then have access to things if it was needed in a moment's notice. Like, and so his inclusion in films, in film soundtracks, and all these other things started to sort of have a little bit of a hockey stick ramp to it because the tracks were available to hand over to the people that needed them, you know.
Yeah.
Steams, tracks, whatever we needed. So it's been a good thing. It's yielded a lot of separate products, you know.
Yeah.
I still work in that area with him.
I want to come back to that in a second, but take us back to Yellow Brick Road.
Oh, okay. So my first contact with Yellow Brick Road was, if you've ever seen the movie Almost Famous, I was like that young guy in Almost Famous. I lived in Las Vegas with my mom. I was always going to the rock shows. I knew all the security guys, all the booking guys in Vegas. And I had no problem getting backstage to meet the bands that I wanted to meet and hang out. So, and at that time I was 15, 16 years old. So I introduced myself to Elton when he came to Vegas, and I brought my mom with me. And my mom had had these hit records that were huge in England. And so he was immediately floored. He was like, oh my God, it's Sue Thompson. He was super excited. And there was a friendship that we struck up there. And my mom loves Elton. So that led to us communicating a lot at the time. And I wanted to go to Europe to go to school when I was 17. And I'd seen Elton in L.A. right after he's tried to start Yellow Brick Road at Bob Marley's studio in Jamaica. And as things would have it, they weren't able to really get it going. They spent a week or so down there and didn't even get a sound on tape. It was frustrating for them. They moved at a different speed and there was a different tempo down there and they wanted to kind of crank out an album really quick. So he came to LA to do promotion for Don't Shoot Me, I'm Only the Piano Player, and told me that what he was planning on doing was going back to France to record at the Chateau where they had done Honky Chateau and Don't Shoot Me, I'm Only the Piano Player. So he was going to go back again and see if he could get this album made as quick as possible. So I said, I'm going to go to school in Europe, I hope, and I have to go interview at these schools. And he said, well, if you're going to be there, come by the sessions. Of course, you can. It blew my mind, right? So yeah. May of 73, I went to France, and I was there for about the last 10 days of recording Yellow Brick Road. But the whole album, they weren't there any more than 3 weeks, so I was there for probably half of it. They knocked that album out in about 20 days. 21 days.
Pretty amazing.
Pretty amazing. Yeah. It's a track a day almost completely.
Yeah.
So I went back to England with Elton and stayed at his house in Virginia Water in Surrey for about 6 weeks after that. And I got to know a lot of people that I had always wanted to get to know. You know, I got to know Gus Dudgeon better. I got to know David Henschel better. It exposed me to, you know, being able to learn a lot about the record business at that time, because Elton had set up Rocket Records in Wardour Street in Soho, and he was signing artists. So I met Dave Stewart for the first time then. Dave was signed to Elton's label in a band called Long Dancer, who were Kai Olsen, who's Nigel Olsen's brother, Elton's drummer, was the guitarist in the band, and Dave was the other guitarist. So at this early stage, I was seeing, you know, what ended up becoming rock royalty, you know?
Yeah.
And then you fast forward to the future. And when we started doing the surround mixes and thinking about repurposing his catalog, I started on Made in England, which was an album that I had produced with him in London in 1994. And I thought that that would be the obvious thing. And nobody would sort of question what I would do with that creatively. So I got two or three songs into it, played it for management. Elton was on the road doing the Billy Joel Elton tour. And he rang me in London and said, how's it sound? And I said, I think everybody's digging it. It sounds really good because I've gone for a playback over there. And he said, listen, I've been talking to UMG at the time, Polydor, or what was forming as UMG. And he said, you know, I really think you should just drop it and start with Yellow Brick Road. And I was when they picked me up off the floor, the first thing I did was I got in the cab and I went to the vault, and I would love Jane Hitchin. She's a sweet lady that ran the vault in Maida Vale in London. I just showed up and said, I'm here to get the multi-tracks for Goodbye Yellow Brick Road. And she was like, what, you know, who are you? She was wonderful. Anyway, I eventually convinced her, and it's funny because Lucian Grange, who is, the managing director, well, the CEO of UMG for the world now.
Sure.
He sent a car for me. He said, I'm bringing you to my office. And I went in and he talked sternly to me. He said, I don't know what you're going to do with this, but, you know, we have a plan for all these things. And it was great. I set him at ease and we went back to Air Studios and we got the tapes. We went back to Air. And when we brought them in a trolley, it was me and Andy Strange, my buddy who was helping me at the time, Air engineer, George Martin and Giles Martin, standing in the lobby of Air Studios in Hampstead, scratching our heads going, how are we going to do this? And it was really cool because George and Giles were sort of, well, you know, you could do this, you could do that. And so we just started playing with it. And it ended up being that was the first 5-1 album that I ever did. And it won a lot of awards, and it was really, really, really well received. And I just finished doing it in Atmos.
Let's go to Atmos.
Okay.
Well, you had all this experience in surround and 5.1, and I would assume that helped you when it came to Atmos. But I don't know if that's true or not.
No, it's a different beast. There's a lot more going on in Atmos, and there's a lot more. It's an extremely powerful environment to work in. By virtue of the fact that you start big, and you can derive almost any type of output mix that you need from within the renderer that's doing all the work for you, placing the not only the tracks or the bed tracks, which would have been sort of the basis for the original 5.1, 7.1, 9.1 type mixes. It also gives you the capability to use objects, which are non-track based. They are non-track based audio track, audio files that are impregnated with metadata. And the renderer, whenever it's played through the renderer in a theater, in a home environment, it then knows where to put that data. So it goes beyond track count. If you had a 7.1 bed, for example, you could have as many as 118 objects.
Wow.
Which the film guys love because it gives them the ability to move a lot of stuff around. The concept behind it is that you're not baking in when you mix. You're not completely baking in all the stuff. So if you want to go back and change something, it's very easy to do. It allows you to, as I said, start big and then output 7.1, 5.1, LCR, stereo files from that master in one pass.
Wow.
You can output stereo, you can output binaural, headphone mixes. So it's extremely powerful to mix within, because once you set that mix up, it's very, very easy for you to go back and alter something.
And it translates?
It translates great. Yeah. Yeah. So you mean the fold downs?
Yeah.
Yeah. It folds down great. And additionally, when you need to up mix something into Atmos, if you have ever done that, if you've ever taken a stereo track and then unfolded it, you can actually play with that type of scenario. And in Atmos, there's some pretty magical stuff that happens, and you don't get a lot of residual sort of artifacts from it, or phasing problems. I find it a really, really great environment to work in. My first Atmos mix, I didn't know how to approach it at all, you know, because I just couldn't imagine the concept of that many possibilities. So I had been talking to Andy Nelson, the great re-recording engineer who is, he has a room at Fox, and he does Jim Cameron's films and Spielberg's films and the Star Wars films, the like. He had just put in an Atmos system in his room at Fox. And we were having dinner one night together, and he said, "Greg, I got to show you this new sound system I've got." And this is 5 years ago now. So this is early 2014. And so I went down to Fox. I took my son Felix with me. We went down to Fox, and he played me all these demos for Atmos, and I was blown away. And at the end of it, I said, "You know, that's amazing, man. I wish I had these tools to play with." He said, "You do have these tools to play with, and you should do something in the music space with this." So, of course, I'm thinking, how can I do this? And I came up with a few ideas. So we went to Dolby, and we proposed that I remix some Elton tracks from the multitracks. And they suggested a couple of different ways that I could prep the tracks so that the mixing process would be easier. For example, make stems that have EQ and compression on them already, bring those files to Dolby. So we went to Burbank, to Dolby's screening room, where they had a full Atmos setup. And Brian Pennington, who is one of the house guys with Dolby, who normally sits on the set or the mix set with the likes of Andy and other mixers like Paul Massey, Brian helped me through it. And he really enlightened me as to how to use Atmos. So probably we spent a long day mixing a couple of different tracks of Elton's in Atmos. And everybody loved it. So my suggestion, of course, was, and having had been there already and gone to the major labels to repurpose things in 5.1, et cetera, I suggested that we start that process. It was not really within Dolby's model at the time with Atmos to do that. And they had to figure out how to allot the manpower to doing that and what it would mean. So there was a long period where nothing happened. You know, we were playing the track for people. We were playing other tracks for folks. But it was mostly film things or, you know, the trailers that are condensed sound effects and things, mm-hmm. helicopters, you know, all the stuff that you do in that kind of format. Until 2 years ago when I got a call from Barrick Moffett at UMG, and he said to me, "Man, I've heard the Rocketman mix, and we want to know what you're doing and what you want to do." So I went in to see him, and he said, "We've put together this room at Capitol that's an Atmos mixing room now, and we want to make records this way. So would you come and make records with us?" And I said, "Of course. This is what I've been wanting to do." So we started in, and we're moving through a lot of the UMG catalog to create enough content to eventually to take through a lot of different exhibition mediums as premiere sort of versions, like Giles Martin mixed Sgt. Pepper in Atmos, and it was played back in the black theaters in a dark room. Giles also did the NXS Kick album, and I've done tons of mixes. I as a matter of fact, an interesting gig for me was UMG asked me to go to Rome to record the Vatican Choir in the Sistine Chapel.
Wow.
So, and the purpose of it was to create an Atmos experience where you feel like you're in the Sistine Chapel.
Wow.
So a little over a year ago, I went to Rome and we did that. We recorded a Christmas concert of the Vatican Choir.
Okay. Did you approach that differently in terms of recording, knowing that it's going to go to Atmos rather than any other format?
Well, typically I would be, and the likes of me, other engineers would, they would source their material from a pop multitrack. And then they would basically make some judgment calls about how to place things, how they want the reverbs to sound and stuff like that. But with the Sistine Chapel thing, I was very, very lucky to work with an extremely talented classical engineer named Stefan Flock, who's based in Berlin. He's of the Emil Berliner Studio team. So he met me there, we talked about it in advance. We decided that we wanted to create a mic plot that would be 16 microphones. So basically using two Fostex field recorders, we would record at 192. And we would place the mics in a certain position in the room, which would be much greater than what he would normally do if he was recording in there, because he had recorded a couple of earlier choral concerts there. So what I had hoped that it would be in the end would be like if you were standing in the center of the Sistine Chapel, you would basically hear the mics as they were in the room, and that would make it feel as though you were exactly in the room. I wasn't sure if it would come out, but sure enough, it did. And we used a Sennheiser Ambio mic to get height and to get that reflective stuff from the ceiling and the cupolas, the walls, and it's all marble. I mean, if you've ever been in it, it's phenomenal. It's even weirder to be in there by yourself. There was a couple of minutes where I was actually in there alone and thinking, wow, you know, this is incredible. It's really a beautiful sounding room. And the end result was that it feels like you're in the Sistine Chapel. So we mixed the entire hour and a half show, and it came out amazing. And we shot it with six extended range 4K cameras, and it's just beautiful.
Wow.
It came out really, really, really good. There's one area of it that was rather interesting that not many people will ever hear. And that was that the night of the performance, at a rehearsal night and a performance night, the night of the performance, we weren't aware, but Cecilia Bartoli, the wonderful Italian mezzo-soprano, came to sing this thousand-year-old song called Bita Vescara. And she was the featured soloist for the evening. But they had not told us that the night before. There was a guy that sang it the night before. So, and they get their pitch from just, you know, the soloist will determine the pitch with the first few lines, And then the choir master will feed that pitch like, you know, to the choir, and they'll go from there. But in this case, she showed up and said, I don't want to be filmed, but it's the first time that a woman had sung in the Sistine Chapel. So we recorded it, and it's amazing, amazing.
Wow. That sounds like a wonderful experience. I can't wait to hear it, actually.
Oh, yeah. I'll play it for you.
Yeah.
It's amazing. It's absolutely amazing. And so the good thing about UMG is that we have some mechanisms where we can push these things out. So when the cut came back for the visuals, we remixed the audio at Capitol, in the Atmos room at Capitol, Nick Reeves and I, and a couple of days to work on it, to sort of make sure that there weren't any sort of the segues in between the pieces weren't too noisy. There was a lot of ambient noise in the room. The performance was done in front of about 100 bishops, and they're not thinking that there's a recording going on, so they're moving around in their chairs and stuff like that. So if in between the performances, we tried to mitigate a bunch of that. But the good thing about UMG is that we have – it's owned by Vivendi, and Vivendi also own Canal Plus. So Canal have a channel in Europe that is a high-res streaming channel for video and audio. So they launched that service by playing on consumer devices the version of the Sistine Chapel piece that we did in Rome in a room with journalists. So they played it as though it would be streaming into your home. And it worked out really, really good. So it's streaming on that channel in Europe right now. And then we've started doing UMG and Dolby announced their partnership about 10 days ago. But it's actually been, we've been active at making tracks against the delivery of the format for a little over a year now.
Well, I wanted to talk to you about that. Who is the ultimate consumer here? And we both know there was a problem with 5.1 in that, first of all, there wasn't an audience like everyone thought there was going to be. And then the fact of the matter is, when someone would buy a 5.1 system, it wouldn't be calibrated properly, and we'd have speakers that'd be in other rooms and all sorts of craziness like that. So Atmos is another level of complexity still. How does that play into it?
Well, I think that Dolby and their partners, their electronics partners, even Apple, are trying to come to an agreement about, first, the format, so there aren't too many format wars. But also, Atmos does a much better job of determining with your receiver what your speaker placement and playout is. So in other words, if you're in your home and you decide to stream Goodbye Yellow Brick Road in Atmos, but you only have a 5.1 system, it does a very, very good job of taking those elements and knowing where to put them within a 5.1 system rather than a full Atmos system. Whereas I guess Elliot Schreiner used to say, you know, that the coefficients just don't work when you do fold downs, you know.
Yeah.
But in the case of Atmos, I test it in my mixes anyway. I test it pretty thoroughly before outputting, and I'll make some adjustments if I feel something isn't quite fitting into the suitcase, you know, down. And it seems to work really well. So for the consumer, I think that there is a little more enlightenment out there because Atmos has now been in the cinema world for about 8 years, really actively. And a lot of people understand it when they're looking, you know, when they're watching their films and stuff. When Apple announced the inclusion of Atmos in their current 4K Apple TV, that was a big moment because they were talking about all of the Apple Music product eventually, if it was an Atmos mix, being able to be pushed through that. Same with the electronics manufacturers. So now that we're at the point now where we've captivated some hearts and minds with the format, with the experience of listening to music in Atmos, and now we need to do the educational part of it to show the consumer that it can be easier than you think. I know for me, my Atmos rig didn't take me very long to set up at all in my studio. Once I grokked it. You know, I just, it was quite easy and it plays back fine. It's very good. So it's, I think that there'll be a place for it. I think the ease of being able to buy or stream your product online will help. There was a lot of, well, do I buy the SACD or the DVD-A or do I do this or I do that with the previous formats? And I think that the competition between the two and the way that the labels license their material for those formats, I think it got confusing. It was sort of consumer hostile.
Yeah.
And I'm hoping that Atmos doesn't end up being that way. I know there's a great drive to educate. There's a great drive within the digital team who make these deals for the world once these titles come out at UMG. There's a great drive so that the consumer sitting in their living room can be educated. So that I know they're working on all that now.
What's the calibration like? Speaker calibration?
In terms of volume or in terms of just...
Both, actually. Placement, level.
Yeah. It's not unlike, if you can imagine a 7.1 bed or a 5.1 bed. Let's start with that. So if you imagine your normal 5.1 bed where you have a center channel, in my case, I always put my subwoofer behind the center channel just because I like hearing the LFE information coming from the center of the room, yeah. Kind of like a kick drum in front of bass in front of you. And then my monitors are out 30 degrees. My left and right are out 30 degrees from the center. And my surrounds would have normally been at something like 120 degrees. But with Atmos, you go further to the back of the room with your monitors. They don't exactly have to be right on the back wall. They don't have to be 180 degrees behind you, but they have to be far enough back where you feel that you have a back to the room. And then in 7.1, you're setting up side speakers. So that side can fill well between the front and the rear. Mm-hmm. And then with Atmos, because of it being object-based and adaptive, I don't have to worry if I want to put something, let's say, between the front left speaker and the side left speaker. If I want something to exist in space here, it's very accurate at putting it in that position and reproducing it in that position. A little bit between the two speakers. And then because we have the overheads now, you have the ability to move that sound in a vertical manner. So you can actually put something sort of hovering in space up in the air to your left, and the speakers will each take care of a little bit of that information. Now, if I then take my mixes to a room like Capitol, where they have a 9.1.6 setup, there is a speaker that is in that position between the front left and the left side speaker. In that format, mm-hmm. In that speaker format, but it'll reproduce exactly in that spot. And then if you blew it out, like we've done tests at the Dolby Theater on Hollywood Boulevard, there's probably 40 speakers in the room. And the pinpoint accuracy of where your information comes from is very, very good.
Wow.
So I don't think the consumer, if you know enough to do a basic placement, and there's lots of graphic illustrations online when you Google Atmos theater setup, mm-hmm. home theater setup, you should be able to view that and get an idea where to put your speakers. You don't always have to have an elaborate system where you have the overhead suspended from the ceiling or something. You can also use, for example, Klipsch and Focal make speakers that have up-firing top speakers,
yeah.
And you get a reflective image. And they also come with a tuning device. So when you set them up, you put a microphone in the room and it will test, it'll do the delays and everything for you.
Wow.
So both the Klipsch and Focal that I've heard are very, very good. So you get the imaging from your up speakers. There is a dedicated up speaker, but it just so happens to be built into the top of your left, right. In this case, it's a 7.1.4. So it'd be your left, right, and rear left and right. And that up-firing speaker does a really great job of bouncing off your ceiling and coming back down.
Wow.
And if you want to take it down even lower, there's the Sennheiser soundbar is amazing. It has some incredible up-firing speakers in it that, as a matter of fact, a lot of people feel that it gives a more, even a more dimensional feeling than actually having the whole surround speakers. It is a wonderful device. So that, you know, it's a soundbar that just sets in front of your TV,
yeah,
or your system. And then there's a pod that I was blown away by, and I'm not sure if it's going to be a branded. I'm not really sure who the manufacturer is going to be, but I've seen a white label version of it. And it's it has up firing speakers in it too, not unlike the HomePod, you know, where you have a whole array of speakers pointing different directions inside the thing. It's phenomenal. It's really good.
Wow.
So it's we're hoping Sonos are working on, you know, this way that they have of identifying if your amp is putting out Atmos and you've got your LCR in the front, or you've got your version of that with Sonos soundbar, whatever it is, and maybe you have a speaker in your dining room and a speaker in your kitchen. Those speakers can become another part of your whole Atmos setup if you want them to be, if you name them to be that. So they're working on that kind of technology.
So when you're mixing, how do you approach the height channels then?
That's a really, really good question. So there's various ways that you can do it. So right now, Pro Tools is the master DAW for Atmos. So within Pro Tools, there are integrated Atmos tools. When you buy or acquire the Atmos production suite as a plugin, it's a $300 plugin that you can buy from the Avid site. You are given a renderer, Adobe renderer, and the panning tools that pop up within Pro Tools so that you can do all of the busing and assignments. Basically, what it does is it's a busing configuration where you're taking your output channels that you would normally send to a device that captures it, or maybe back into Pro Tools, or you would bounce to disk. You're sending those channels to the renderer, and the renderer is, like I said, impregnating those the channels that you're sending with the necessary data to know whether it's a bed channel or not, whether it's an object, and where that object should be in space. Then it sends it back through to Pro Tools, and it comes up another set of channels, which are your speaker control channels. It seems complicated, but in fact, once you get a template, it's super easy. Like now, I can open my Atmos template and drop a multi-channel mix in, a multi-channel tape into it, multi-channel recording, and within a few minutes, it's coming out of all the speakers. I can put it wherever I want. So you can, there are several ways that you can reach your upper hemisphere. On the panner that then is enabled from the Atmos plugin, you can use a height feature. So basically, it lifts it up. Now, there are a couple of caveats when that happens. As with anything that has tons of things going on, you have some trade-offs that you have to do. So if you have a 7.1.4 system, for example, and you want to put something discreetly in the upper left front channel, if you use the height function in the home theater renderer, it will put it into the upper channel, but it will most probably also be in the rear channel. So it kind of sends it up, but it makes the entire upper hemisphere a stereo pair.
Yeah, yeah.
Now that's when you use it from the height channel on a trackbed. And that can be very effective when you just want something to feel like it's got some altitude to it. But if you want to be super discreet about it, you could turn that track into an object. And then you have discrete access to any speaker in the room or any position in the room. Yeah. And a lot of times what I'll do is I'll create geographical destinations in the form of objects. So in other words, I'll put objects in different places in the room where I know I'm eventually going to want to put a sound, or I'm going to want to get there and then come back out again. So for example, you can also cut and paste, or you can do, like, let's say you had a track and you had a whole bunch of music and you wanted to synchronize the arrival of the sound rhythmically with the track in a different speaker each time. You could actually cut that up and just assign the sub stems that you would make from a master track, just cut it into rhythmic slices and then assign each of those slices to a destination, and it'll start playing that way.
Wow.
So there's all kinds of different ways that you can access it, but your real super discreet stuff should be an object. It works the best. It's extremely accurate, and there's real good reasons why you want to do that. However, one thing that I will throw in, and maybe I don't want to jump ahead of you, but bus compression in pop music is almost like trying to cook without salt if you don't have bus compression.
Right.
You know, you gotta have that thing. So one of the big challenges with Atmos that I found first time I used it was, how do I get that punch? There's no bus. It's tons of tracks, you know, and objects. So I've got 10 tracks in a bed, and then I've got 20 objects. That's a lot, you know? So what do you do? Do you chain up 30 compressors? I mean, you can do that and key them off of something. Bus compression scheme is one of the big challenges, you know, where your objects are getting compressed with the whole track. So you get that breathing, but there's ways to do it.
How about effects? Because that was one of the things in the early days of 5.1, for instance, where we had stereo effects, and it took forever to get 5.1 effects. And then it was like, well, okay, how do you actually deploy this? So how does it work in Atmos?
Well, you can do a few different things. So I'll give you a couple of different scenarios. The fun has been, the fun at UMG has been that we've set up new rooms. So I get to go to these new rooms that we have set up and try new things, you know, every time. I tried something in Nashville recently at our Berry Hill. UMG bought the Berry Hill studio complex in Nashville that used to belong to the House of Blues. Mm-hmm. And we put two Atmos rooms in there. So one of the things that I tried was, I don't know if you've used the Fab Filter plugins.
Yeah. Oh, love them.
So I'll name brands, but that's probably okay.
Yeah.
So the Fab Filter plugins are wonderful, and they make a wonderful reverb, a wonderful stereo reverb. So what I did is I just created a single send from Pro Tools into four different stereo channels of the Fab Filter reverb. And then I positioned the return of the reverb. If you can imagine the room as four slices, that you have a horizontal plane reverb in front of you, and then you have a reverb that's maybe a little bit more vertical. Maybe it's predominantly in your front overhead Atmos speakers, and then it goes back and it's in your rear Atmos speakers, and then the fourth instantiation of the reverb would be in your wall in the back. And then you set the pre-delay, times gradually longer, and you set the decay gradually longer.
Yeah.
When you hit that reverb, it washes past you like a wave.
Wow.
And it's super subtle, but it all of a sudden gives you this sense that sound is traveling past me, you know? So things like that can be super easy to set up in Atmos. And you can just assign them to object destinations if you want.
That's awesome.
Yeah, it's a phenomenal thing. And then you could, you know, if you really want to get crazy, you can take those reverbs and start to move them. You can do quite a lot within that. But that way you get this feel. I like some of the 5.1 reverbs in my System 6000. So what I've done is I've set up an upper hemisphere return on the 6000. So I get this kind of this feeling of reflections that are going between the upper area, like there was maybe an upper part of the room that's not particularly geometrically perfect, that's bouncing around. And that gives you this subtle feeling that it's not just a box above your head.
Yeah.
It's actually, you know, kind of splashing around, which is pretty cool.
How long does it take you to do a mix? Is it faster than stereo, or is it slower?
It's slower. Now you could tear into it and try to, if you were on, a deadline and you needed to keep to a certain deadline, we've worked out some ways that you can prep for Atmos. So the best thing to do is be prepared, you know, take your tracks. If your tracks are in stereo already, make them as ready for Atmos as possible. In other words, maybe do your basic rides, do your basic compression, EQ, stuff like that, and have it all ready so that it's playing back well in the stereo field. And then you can just start to move it around. And that's the fastest way to get started. Start to assign it to different places.
So you're talking premixes, basically. You're doing stems.
Yeah. Yeah, it's stems, but I almost never go back and create. For example, I wouldn't do a drum group stem, like a stereo drum group for Atmos. I want everything to still be discrete so that I can move it around a little bit if I want.
Yeah. And
it is really nice working with the absolute, you know, everything in the original multi-track pieces when you're in Atmos, because there just seems to be something that happens to the whole imaging that's bigger. It's great to be able to go in and fine tune the hi-hat or something like that, or take the kick and play with it. When if they were put into a stem, it would be a little bit harder for you to get in and do that.
Yeah, right.
It can take. You could probably do an Atmos mix a day if you really were on it. I've spent 4 days on a mix. I did a version of Start Me Up by the Stones, and I didn't have any notes. And but I think the way that Bob originally mixed it, Claremont mixed it, and I think the original record, and I think the way that he mixed it was using the cut buttons on the SSL. There was a ton of, I mean, that album was cobbled together. It was outtakes, and Mick had gone to Paris and over the course of about 6 weeks made an album out of a bunch of outtakes. And so it was not, to start with, it was a bit of a mess. So on 16 channels. So to actually make it work, you need a guy with a mind like Bob. So, I mean, Bob probably knocked that mix out in no time, and it just sounds amazing. But to replicate Bob's mix in Atmos for a project that we were doing, it took me a few days to really figure out where everything was, make sure it played back in the same way, and then make it bigger. So that's the challenge. The challenge is repurposing things in Atmos that are going to have the same impact or more on the listener. And there's such subtle things in these classic historic records that you really got to get them. You can't just fake it. You got to really get them right.
Yeah.
So that's one of my goals when I start an Atmos mix, is it's got to be as good or better than the original mix.
But that's always been the problem with that, because so much goes on in mixing that's, like you say, undocumented. What reverbs were used, what effects were used, and you have to hunt to figure this stuff out. So, yeah, I know. It can take forever.
Or Ken's things, where Ken Scott's things, where yeah. Ken would be with Gus in the control room mixing Tonky Chateau, and he would, you know, it'd be six hands on the desk doing rides, and you've got to chase that in your Atmos mix of it. And they were doing Dolby stretch tricks and all kinds of stuff, and you no notes on any of that. It was late and somebody just decided the vocals would sound better if we popped the Dolby out, you know, whatever. But you can't find that stuff. So
Yeah, right.
They mixed in sessions too. But I think that is the game. It's fun for me. I kind of almost, it's like a challenge, you know, to do it.
Yeah.
It is an incredibly creative form. What I'm trying to encourage artists that I talk to about it is to write in the format. Write using Atmos, write monitoring back out of Atmos in a setup that has the speakers, so that you can really start to feel, you know, anew. And I think Beck is interested in doing that, actually, because he's been at Capitol quite a lot lately, checking in on it.
Yeah.
So I think he's got an idea.
Very cool. All right, Greg, last question. What's the best piece of business advice that you've either learned along the way or maybe somebody imparted to you?
I think you've got to stick to it and understand that if you're going to work in the music business, there are going to be oscillations of success and oscillations where you feel like you're on a desert island somewhere and that nobody is returning your calls. Nobody's there when you call out. I think the thing is learning how to ride the oscillations of the business and zooming out far enough, if you can do it, to see the big picture and to hopefully say, I'm here to last. And I know there's going to be changes. There's going to be changes in the industry, changes in the technology, changes in your, you know, if you're a talented person who is trying to do things, you know, there's all the adages that come with it. Like, you know, find me this guy, who's this guy, you know, all that stuff.
Yeah. Right.
I think really it's tenacity, it's sticking to it, and really, really work at your craft. Really try to be good at what you And you can say, in the long run, it was a pretty good ride.
Thanks for listening and being in my inner circle. Remember, if you have any questions or comments, send them to questions@bobbyoinnercircle.com. To listen to the episodes of Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle, go to bobbyosinski.com and select the podcast tab, or go to bobbyoinnercircle.com, where you can find it on iTunes, Stitcher, Mixcloud, Google Play, Google Podcasts, Spotify, Deezer, and now Radio Public. At bobbyosinski.com and bobbyoinnercircle.com, you'll also find a sign-up form for my newsletter and for alerts for new podcasts. This is Bobby Osinski. I will see you next time.